The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on the 1st of March 2019. Happy St. David's Day, by the way. On today's podcast, I have James Carter, Chief Executive Officer of DigitalBox, DBox. And James explains their business model on their second day of trading. They listed yesterday. Also on the podcast, I have Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. And Russ talks about the US economy and the following companies: Alpha Financial Markets Consulting, Morse's Club, and Vodafone. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, with a whole bunch of other content. For example, Market Musings with Peter Webb, ex-fund manager, that is, and a question and a answer session video with the chairman of W Resources, Michael Masterman. And there's also other bits of blogs, content, and podcasts right there at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is James Carter, Chief Executive Officer of DigitalBox. That's DBox, is ticker. James, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Thank you.
Yeah, and I saw you mentioned quite a bit yesterday's float on social media. People are getting quite excited about that and sharing some information. And I've added you to my watch list already. I quite like anything to do digital, especially revenue generating, and you're generating a profit. Before we go into the details of what you hope to achieve, though, James, just give us a brief summary as to what DigitalBox is all about, please.
Of course, yes. DigitalBox is a pure play mobile-first digital media business that we established initially in 2016 through a brand called Entertainment Daily, which effectively is TV and showbiz celebrity news. And very quickly, we managed to create a mobile delivery method that was highly profitable and significantly ahead of our competitors in the market. So if we consider key competitors in that space being the Daily Mail or the Sun or Heat magazine or Closer magazine, none of them make money through a mobile distribution route. We do.
Yeah, okay. I like the sound of it. So essentially, where do you earn your money? So it comes from what? Mobile advertising. Is that right? Across any platform? How does it work?
Yeah, mobile advertising historically has been playing catch up because it's basically mobile audience levels are higher, obviously, than desktop audience levels. It's about 70% of internet consumption is via mobile. Advertising has been historically skewed towards desktop. So there's a surge of advertising coming through onto mobile devices in order to sort of marry with the number of eyeballs you could see on a mobile device. We run a very, very lean operation that uses something called programmatic advertising. And essentially what that means is all of our advertising is transacted automatically. So effectively, if you visit our website, your profile would be put out to auction to a number of advertising exchanges. They will take a view on how much they're prepared to pay for you. They'll take a view on how much the site is worth and its general user experience, and then bid in real time for the opportunity to present an ad for you. That all happens in about 0.65 milliseconds. And then advertising units are served. And that's really as simple as how we make our money.
You said there, you mentioned you're a lot more effective than some other big players like Daily Mail, The Sun. So why is that? What are you doing they're not doing? And what's the competition like in this market? Because I know a while back, a couple of years back now, but Google started penalising companies that weren't mobile friendly, and they awarded search results for people who were mobile friendly, and everything sort of flipped. And it's been like the cash card thing. You know, people have gone from paying with cash out of cards, and it's almost like everyone's going from websites to mobile. And yet people are trying to play catch-up. So why are you doing it, and will they catch up with you or not?
will they catch up with us? Well, I suppose the first point is we took the view in 2016 that we should look as far forward as possible, because if we created a model that was ahead of the competition, clearly it would give us a significant advantage. So at that stage, none of our key competitors were making money out of mobile, and I still don't believe any of them are. The reason we're able to do that is because we don't have legacy issues attached to our business, and we've had the freedom just to look forwards. So if you think about if you're a print business with a magazine sales that are seeing decline, you're constantly looking over your shoulder and wondering what you're going to do about those declining revenues, as, instead of looking forwards in a very pure way, as we have done, at the future. I think that's been given a label as a sort of piece of business behavior. I think it's called Innovator's Dilemma. Mm-hmm. And I think it exists in multiple markets. It's not unique to the media market, but you can see it's at play with traditional media players. That is the case for the Daily Mail. It's the case for magazine publishing companies. What they have managed to do quite slowly is transition their businesses from print to desktop. And now they've got another whole transition journey to move with, which is from desktop to mobile.
Yeah.
So our, you know, the big benefit for us is we're already there and we're already making money, and we'll continue to refine our business around where audiences are in the future.
Yeah, do you know what? I was talking about this with another tech founder on the podcast yesterday, and I was just reading Jeff Bezos' biography on Amazon, and everyone said in the first few years that, you know, they were selling books, and everyone said, well, Barnes & Noble, who are the biggest books, you know, store in America, said, we'll just do that and wipe you out, you know? And he said, well, first and foremost, online. He tried to defend it in the end. He gave up, but he said, you know, online, people aren't convinced by online yet. And secondly, it's a different model. You know, you have to refocus completely. It's a different business model. You can't just shift a little bit. You have to, you know, allocate new staff, set up new operations. It's not that easy, you know? So if we are 100% focused on the online books, they are not. And it turns out he was right. I mean, Barnes & Noble tried, you know, the biggest bookstore in America tried to do online, but not as successfully as Amazon, who are a new, you know, upstart, a new startup. So I can see what you mean. So at the moment, so your content is coming from Entertainment Daily and the Daily Mash, is that right?
Well, at the moment, Entertainment Daily is the site that we've grown in the UK. We have about 3 million audience monthly on that has really high session frequency with us. So we have about between 10 and 15 million sessions a month from that particular platform. We are acquiring, as part of this RTO, we're acquiring the Daily Mash, which will conclude on Tuesday the 5th. Yes, that will complement the current business that we have, because it's a very, very lean operation that runs a programmatic only advertising model like us. But we think we can add our platform and our technologies to benefit that particular site, chiefly because they are a smaller owner operated business than us. Then they don't have the access to the kind of conversations that we have in the ad market. They don't have the kind of access to the technology that we have. And just to pull out one particular example, we have a piece of technology which we've labelled Columbus, which we've produced ourselves, and effectively that is a micro caching system that sits at the front end of our site. And what that does is accelerate the site speed and user experience for anyone that visits. And if you run an online test on Google to compare Entertainment Daily with the Daily Mail, for example, then you'll see that Entertainment Daily loads at four times the speed of something like the Daily Mail in particular in that test. Yeah. That really does give us a significant advantage, and we'll be able to transport that advantage onto the Daily Mash as well. So, you know, we'll be taking all of the positive pieces of technology that we implement on Entertainment Daily on everything else that we identify and buy.
Yeah. So, and as far as more content, because of course this content is obviously working for you now, but in the entertainment world it's very fickle. There, are you always looking for more kind of content, more publishers to acquire?
Yes, we are, and the market is rich with opportunity. We think, or we know. I think if you look at traditional publishers, including TI Media, formerly known as Time Inc. in the UK, which were the historically the UK's biggest magazine publisher, then they have assets for sale. I think it's quite public knowledge that they are putting some things into the market for people to look at. Acquiring. There's opportunity there. There's opportunity across also pure play digital media businesses. There's been quite a lot of overvaluation over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. I think a good example of that is there was a site called Mike in the US, MIC, which is a millennial news site, that was initially valued at $100 million and sold about 3 months ago for $5 million. There's a great deal of value in that business, and there's opportunities to acquire things that have been overvalued and not had a profit focus. And I think the thing that has driven our business from day one is the ability to create a profit was absolutely king. Because we had to self-fund the growth of the business.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, I said exciting days for you, just listed. And if someone's listening right now, James, like the sound of what you're doing, but are not following the story, which is forgivable, as it's, like I said, second day trading, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Of course, yeah. I think, number one, we're a cash-generative business. Which is not always the case in the AIM market, so we're a relatively rare species. Mobile, I think, is a really important aspect to this. The fact that we are profitable on a mobile journey, which most media competitors are not profitable in, and the fact that money flowing into mobile continues to flow at a disproportionate rate because it's playing catch up in its monetization, gives us a real advantage and a potential future value that will be much greater. And I think the market is rich with opportunity, being the third reason, really. Everyone will be aware that there are opportunities out there, both large and small, and opportunities we can and will demonstrate with the Daily Mash that we can convert into a much more successful business through our formulas.
Yeah,
and I guess on top of that, I've got skin in the game. I think was what was asked of me before we were raising money. And myself, I've got 12% as CEO, and the COO has got 12% of the business. So it's vitally important, really, for us to drive this and build this business as we go forwards.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I always look for that as an investor. I always look for the shareholder register because it's a difference between a manager, essentially, and an owner. And I know an owner with proper skin in the game really drives the business, you know, and really works hard at it rather than just getting a wage, you know, like a manager would.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Marvellous stuff. James, it's good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you? Happy St. David's Day.
Thank you very much. Yes, you too. And I do like this spring. It is an awakening, you know, the daffodils and all that stuff. I do like that.
It's fabulous. Yeah, it's one of my all-time favourite lines in a poem, actually. Philip Larkin. Yeah. It's called Love Songs in Age. And it's a very sad poem, as, let's face it, most of his stuff was. But there's an incredible line in it which talks about, and I'm afraid to say I don't have it anymore, age 49, the unfailing sense of being young. Spread out like a spring woken tree. Yeah. And I just think it's such a clever image. And yeah. So it always makes me think of that. So there we go. The unfailing sense of being young, spread out like a spring woken tree.
Yeah, but you know what? I think as you get older, you do appreciate the seasons more,
yeah,
don't you?
I think that's
right. I mean, when you're young, you don't care. If it's my kids don't care. If it's minus four or...
Yeah. Couldn't give a monkey.
When I said daffodils coming up, I say, do you remember this time last year? It was like a beast in the east. And I said, now we're starting the spring. It's the awakening of the flowers, the plants, and they're rising up in the
exactly.
sun. And they don't really care about that.
I said, look at those crocuses. Do you know who Crocus was? The crocus is named after. They go, yeah, we've heard this one before, Dad. I said, but it's still fascinating, though. Crocus was a Roman, and he didn't want to be forgotten, so he managed to get the plant named after him. So every spring, everybody goes, oh, look, there's a crocus, and so he's never been forgotten, except, obviously, my kids forget from year to year, and even if they don't, they go, whatevers.
I just think, as you get older, just the base of nature, it's just amazing, nothing more powerful, so simple, but so powerful.
And, exactly.
Okay, let's talk about things that are maybe...
Yeah,
more complex.
Other powerful things.
In fact, I was looking at that closely. We did mention before we came on about the American economy and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I know they do annualized GDP, don't they?
It's a bit of a funny number, to be honest with you. Yeah, but that's the one we've got, and that's kind of what we're stuck with. And it has been showing some signs of a slowdown, albeit from pretty rapid levels. I think it was 4.2% in the second quarter, 3.6% in the third, and 2.6% in the fourth. Now, what's interesting is that you can log on and follow these for free, the New York Fed Nowcast and the Atlanta Fed GDP Now forecast, and they're forecasting 1.2 to 1.8% growth for the first quarter of this year. So that, you know, you can see the bar sort of going down.
Yeah,
and I guess there are multiple reasons for that. I think mm-hmm. the sugar rush of the tax cuts is wearing off. There's a base effect, and that's wearing off. The stronger dollar. And the dollar's gone up, that's probably not helping exports too much. You do have some signs that the global economy is slowing, and certainly the trade numbers that the CPB, Netherlands Economic Bureau, put out aren't particularly good right now, so global trade is weakening. And you've had the US government shutdown. So, you know, you've had various different cross currents. But overall, it does look as if the US economy is slowing down a little bit. The upturn's 10 years old, there's way more debt in the system, and of course the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates and it has been withdrawing QE, and that, I think that has been having a bit of an impact, and that's why, after only getting rates to 2.5% compared to the previous cycle bottom, I think about 5.25%, the Fed is already going, we might hold off a little bit here. So I think they are nervous, I think they are conscious of the fact that, you know, there are lots of cross currents out there, and to be fair, the Trump tax cuts, what they haven't done is persuade companies to build vast amounts of new capacity. What a lot of firms have done is they've repatriated their dollars and they've bought their back. They've done share buybacks with them or acquisitions with them, which isn't really quite, I think, necessarily what Potter's had in mind, but that's the way in which it's worked. So what is intriguing is, you know, US consumer confidence, and we were just discussing this, looks to be tracking the S&P 500. Now, which is the chicken, which is the egg? Don't know, but certainly whenever you go to the States, everybody's talking about their 401ks, which is like their ISA, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, what's in it? How is it doing? And don't forget, the Federal Reserve made it public policy under Ben Bernanke. We're going to keep interest rates low. We're going to launch QE to try and drive asset prices up and create a wealth effect. Mm-hmm. Now, that obviously means what happens if you start to put interest rates up, withdraw QE, and stock prices start going down? Does that have the reverse effect, which would be, let's face it, entirely logical? And you can at the moment see that, you know, when that we got that big wobble in the S&P in the fourth quarter of last year, consumer confidence went down very quickly, admittedly from virtually all-time highs, but it went down very quickly. The stock market's bounced, and that consumer confidence has gone up. So the question now is, who's in charge, the Fed, the markets, or the consumer? I don't know the answer, by the way. They could all be prisoners of each other, quite frankly. But it does slightly make you wonder if we did get an unexpected financial market wobble and, you know, a bear market. Let's face it, Justin, we've seen plenty of them and we're probably going to see plenty more. It does slightly make you worry about the foundations of the economic recovery.
Exactly. That, you know, the tax cuts was a temporary shot in the arm, like you say. I mean, it's boosted it. But do you know what? I'm looking at the S&P chart here now and it doesn't look very nice, because what you've got here is...
I know. There's a bit of a multiple, a triple head or something.
Yeah, triple head. That's right. So there's the first one was in 2018 at start there.
Yeah.
Second second one was almost before the dip in September, October, and then we fell down. And now it's just topped out at 2,800. The previous high was 2,900. So it's always worrying when you don't get a beyond that previous
breakthrough.
High, you know?
Yeah, and that reminds me of the old saying, market tops are a process, market bottoms are an event.
Yeah.
And, you know, you will often find market tops, as you've just said, if you go back to 2007, it didn't hit a peak, nobody rang a bell and it went down in a straight line. It was actually still almost a year later from the summer 2007, because it wasn't a million miles away a year later. Yeah. It was a failure to break through that. And then obviously all the bad news came out about subprime, and it market tops are a surprisingly slow moving process, but obviously once, you know, the downward momentum gathers, it gathers incredibly quickly. Whereas with market bottoms, you look at March 09, it's literally like there's a big point down and then a big point up, and the market just doesn't go back to that low again. So they're very different, you know, psychological and physical market phenomena. And I admit I do slightly worry that the Federal Reserve, by backing off and perhaps being pushed around by the financial markets and worries over the consumer, is actually creating the foundations for a melt up. Because if people think the Fed's always going to move when the market goes down, people are just going to keep on piling in regardless. And in a way, it's entirely logical. But that's probably my bigger worry right now, is that you get a melt up before you get a bear market that we've all been frightened of and waiting or waiting for some time. But yeah, I admit the technicals at the moment just look like classic late cycle action to me, I have to say.
Yeah, and you're right. It does. You know, I think it was from Bloomberg. I read an article yesterday about a guy gave a very in-depth sort of discussion about how it's very hard to spot a bear market, because people, like you say, you do get this volatility where we see a nice run-up for 6 months to almost, you know, a rally for 6 months. People think, that's not a bear market, it can't be. But then all of a sudden, it'll come back down again. And so, the volatility is very hard to understand until you're down the bottom. Yeah. That was a bear market.
And it's amazing, actually, recessions are incredibly hard to spot as well. And again, I know, thankfully, it all feels like a long time ago, but 10 years ago obviously was a very frightening time. But it actually took economists 6 or 9 months to tell us we were in a recession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, these things are deceptively difficult. These things are deceptively difficult to spot.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to individual. Of course, it's a market of stocks. It's a stock market, but it's a market of stocks. There's always bargains out there.
Yeah,
You can make money in a bear market if you pick the right stocks. Undervalued stocks are obviously good. And
you can.
And but let's look at some stocks individually then. So what are we looking at, Ross?
So we're going to look at two tiddlers, one that we haven't looked at before and one that we have. And then, again, you've asked me to have a look at a few sort of yield and dividend type plays.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a look at a big cap yield play, though, oddly enough, this time, I actually think it's probably one that you want to wait for, even though the yield looks awfully tempting. I think it's one you probably want to wait, because I think there might actually be a risk of a cut to the divvy coming around the corner.
Okay. Let's go with the first stock then, Russ.
So the first tidbit is one that we've not looked at before. It's Alpha Financial Markets Consulting. It's AIM quoted. It actually joined the market in autumn 2017, 250 million cap. And since it's floated 160p, it's done well, to be fair. It's got up to 250, albeit through a slightly circuitous route. I don't know what patterns you can pick out of that chart, Justin, but it's certainly quite, and it looks like a snail shell to me at various stages. The sort of big curves.
That's a new technical name, a snail shell.
It's a slightly circuitous route. But at the moment, you know, I think the technicals, I'll defer to you, don't look too bad. But I think this is a really interesting company because it provides support services, consulting, advice, assistance to the global fund management community. And they've got 3/4 of the world's top 20 on their customer list already. So that's names like BlackRock, Fidelity, and Vanguard. It advises these companies on new trends and new technologies. It also helps them cut out costs. And let's face it, we all know that they're under fierce margin pressure from passively managed rivals. They're under fierce pressure from regulators. There's competitive pressure from customers in the market. So it helps them automate processes. It helps them redomicile funds. It helps them rationalize their cost base if they do a deal. And at the moment, the earnings momentum is incredibly strong. First half interims showed sales up 35, operating profit up 47. There was a dividend. It's got a net cash balance sheet. I mean, I guess if you're looking for risks, I mean, this is a customer base that is under that is still wildly profitable, but is coming under some pressure. So there's always a little chance they pull their horns in. And the company is recruiting like mad. So you can always get the odd half or odd year when costs go up faster than revenues do. So you could get a bit of an earnings bump. It's got a net cash balance sheet. They might feel they want to do an acquisition, particularly because they're probably, you know, want to grow in the US particularly. But for the growth that you're getting, I know it's on 20 times forward earnings, falling to 18 to 16, but you're looking at trend double-digit earnings growth so far. There's a dividend yield of, what, around 2%, and it just feels to be like a company in the right place at the right time with a strong customer base, net cash balance sheet, and a strong competitive position.
Yeah, do you know what? I don't know what happened on the 2nd of May. I looked around this. No,
I know.
No news.
It just took off there,
and it, like I said, it formed that, that's the start of the rise up. It went up from, what was that, 160 up to sort of beyond 260, then that was the shell of the snail. It came back then to the 200-day moving average, and it's bounced along that nicely now to form the head of the snail. So it's up at 250 again now, so it's looking quite nice really, isn't it?
But fingers crossed.
Yeah, cool. Okay, what's next, Russ?
The next one is Morse's Club, which is one that we've looked at before. One of Wakefield's finest, 200 million market cap. We first looked at it just over a year ago at 137p. It's now at 166, so that's all right. We've got the dividends in the bin as well. It's the UK's leading, second biggest doorstep lender behind Provident Financial. So it provides credit to people who may otherwise struggle to get it, not necessarily because they've got a bad credit history, though that may be the case. It may just be that, you know, that they're unfortunate enough not to have a huge amount of disposable income, and say the washing machine breaks down, they need 300 quid in a hurry. They can't lay their hands on that 300 quid very quickly, and that's where these companies provide a potentially valuable service. It's got scale, it's got good returns on capital, and it tends to specialise in quite short-term loans, which again keeps the risk of customers defaulting on the loan relatively low, I would say. I guess two bits of news here. First of all, you've obviously seen a bid for Provident Financial from a smaller rival, NSF, which is interesting. So, you know, I mean, Provi's been through a torrid 2 years. It's still a degree of turmoil there. So always helps when one of your biggest rivals is a little bit up and down. And we've also had a trading statement ahead of the full year results in April. Loan growth of 7%, including a small acquisition. Customer growth of 2.5% to 235,000, and good progress on the loyalty club card. I mean, they're still looking at select acquisitions going forward. They forecast another increase in the dividend. Analysts are looking for around 7.8p. That's a 4.6% dividend yield, well covered by earnings. And again, unless the UK economy drops in a complete hole and impairments start going through the roof, you know, you should continue to see some pretty decent earnings growth and dividend growth from the company.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's got that double top look about it as well, though. So 175, see if it gets above that, it'd be quite good.
Yeah, but, that's, we'll, I think, see, the all-time high on the stocks. I think that is potentially a technical challenge in the short term, for sure. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, so wait to see if it breaches out or comes back a bit.
Yeah.
Cool. What's next, Ross?
Vodafone.
Cool, yeah.
Big cap yield stock. And let's face it, you see a company yield, a share yielding 9.6%.
Yes.
People are going to think, hello. That looks interesting.
Well, this is it. Do you know what?
Some people might think, hello, what am I missing here? Is this like picking money up in the street, or is there a catch somewhere?
That's it. I mean, there's two sides to this. People, you know, when I first started investing stocks, I was looking for very high dividends. But then I realised, hang on, you've got to research a bit more. And how much are they covered? How likely is it to be sustained? Yep. You know, yep.
This is it. And to be fair, look at the Vodafone chart and tell me what you see.
Exactly. At the moment, it's just gone down for as long as I can. I'm scrolling back. So it's gone down from £2.30 to £1.34 in a long, slow, it's like a death by a thousand cuts. And it's not formed a bottom anywhere. I don't know where it's going to stop yet. So
It's interesting. It tried to rally in January when new boss Nick Reed, who took over from Vittorio Colao last autumn, said, we're not going to cut the dividend in the year to 2018. Can I keep the dividend flat at 15.07 euro cents? And now that still ends a run of 20 consecutive dividend increases. So the company is definitely feeling the strain a little bit. And on the face of it, you just look, well, hang on a minute. The dividend works out about 13p a share. Earnings are forecast to be between 8 and 9p a share. How on earth?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How on earth? Now, it's partly because Vodafone's got quite a complex structure and it's got proportional ownership of a lot of its assets. Free cash flow is forecast to be about 4.8 billion euros this year when the dividend's 3.9.
Okay.
So you think, okay, free cash flow, but that's still only a cover of 1.2, 1.25 times. Mm-hmm. That's not, again, you want to see that much nearer to.
Yeah.
Okay, and to be fair, it looks as if at the moment it's cost cuts and capital investment cuts not top-line growth and profit growth, that are giving Reed the confidence to hold the dividend flat. Now, we'll see when they report their numbers, their full year results in May, what the forecast is for the next year's dividend, because I think that's going to be interesting. And I'm sure that Reed, having just come in, the last thing he'll want to do is get involved in cutting the dividend, because obviously it doesn't look very good. But operating free cash flow, the key planks of that are obviously operating profit. And here, there's margin pressure in its key mobile markets of the Italy, Spain, and the UK. Germany's looking pretty tough. And on the spending side, you've got 5G round the corner. The company's already had to spend more money buying 5G spectrum than it thought in the auctions in the UK and Italy in particular. The German auction comes up this year when the German regulator is even talking about letting a new entrant come into the market. And Mr. Reed's already saying, look, please, Mr. Regulator, don't let use us as a milking machine to raise money for the Treasury. Well, actually, one people, you know, that's clearly his big fear, and he knows that that is potential pressure. So you've got pressure on margins and profits. You've got pressure on the CapEx and the spending. That's not a great combination when your free cash flow covers 1.2 times anyway. To be fair, I think the share price is already largely discounting a cut.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it might not be the end of the world. But I think, it's interesting, you know, Marks and Spencer's cut its dividend, announced a dividend cut this week. Yeah, we talked about this 2 weeks ago. You know, the UK looks very fat for yield. How many of those are safe? And I think some companies, they're possibly slightly strangling themselves in terms of keeping the dividend going when they really need to be investing in their underlying businesses. And M&S has taken the strategic plunge. Whatever you think of the Ocado deal, it's decided actually we need to do something strategically and not just prop up the dividend.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder if now that M&S has kind of slightly open, has gone first through the door, as it were, how many other chief executives will think, they've done it, they've led the way, they've set the precedent. Admittedly, the shares went down 10%, so they'll still think twice about it. But I do wonder over the next year or two whether you'll see a few other really meaty yielding companies. M&S was yielding about 7 to 8. You got Vodafone up at 9.5, you know, which when cash in the bank's yielding what? You know, not much. It's kind of, I think, the market's way of saying, look, this number's just too good to be true. If anything, if they cut the dividend, maybe that's when actually you have another proper look at the stock. Until then, I'd be very wary of taking that 9.5% yield number on trust.
Yeah, well, do you know what? This week, I think Berenberg mentioned a BT new guy CEO may cut the dividend.
Yeah.
And it's dropped like from 230 to 215. But ironically, I said to a friend, by cutting the dividend, it makes the business stronger because you're paying down debts and all that stuff. So in the end, of course, you get the income funds that will pull out initially. We'll see some downward pressure. The threat of that, of course, as well is there. But essentially, then, you build up, get rid of the debt, and then get to a level of standing again where you can start paying dividend again. I think it's sensible business, isn't it, really?
I think in the end, it's the only way. You know, it's not nice. No CEO likes cutting the dividend. They know they're going to get some flack for it. But I think if it's for the strategic and long-term health of the company, I think it's the right thing to do. And in the end, this is a share price that Vodafone is telling you, actually, it's kind of coming. So you almost wonder, let's kind of, get it on.
Normally, though, it's a good... What CEOs normally do is do the kitchen sink, don't they? When they first come in, they do everything.
This is your chance. Yeah,
the guy at Vodafone should have done it straight away and say, OK, listen, cut the dividend, let's cut all the costs, and then give me a year and we'll see where we are. And, now he's having to ease himself in and say, we may have to cut the... may have to go against what he said previously, which is not good.
There you go.
Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Russ.
And, pleasure.
They're on my watch list, Vodafone, because sooner or later they will find a bottom. Who knows where it'll be, but...
keep looking.
Yeah, hopefully maybe... I'll try and get in there close to that, which is a famous last words. Thanks for us. Have a nice weekend.
Have a champion weekend.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five: DigitalBox, DBox. Of course, I talked about those. I talked about James, the CEO of DigitalBox earlier on. Also, in top five is Mitotech Pharma. That's MDPH. MTPH. MTPH. Couldn't remember the ticker there. sorry, just the names here. At 388 Energy. A bit of a big follow today on not very positive news, but there's more news to come that will hopefully get better, they're saying, on the drill that winks one well. At 2, Proactus Holdings. And the ticker there is PHD. It's in a bit of a profits warning. And number one, most followed company, again, a big fall, of course. It's the same asset as 88 Energy. It's Red Emperor Resources, RMP. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, i3 Energy, replacement of 24 million junior loan notes facility. At 4, Alpha Growth, I'm having problems here, acquisition of Culver. At three, Zdenga Iron, investor presentation and project update. At two, Gulf Keystone Petroleum, Shaykan payment update. And number one, most liked RNS came from United Oil and Gas, admission to trading on AIM. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.